thank you all for coming. It's my pleasure to chair this panel. I was asked by the panelists to chair this panel. It's on Century of Black Mormons, a digital history project, and all the people up here have been involved in some sort of way in helping to develop this project. And so we sort of plan to explain the process whereby you go about building a database in this kind of way. I will introduce each of the panelists and then allow them to do their presentations with no interruption from me. So the first presenter today will be Anna Neutrauer. She's the Digital Initiatives Librarian at the University of Utah Marriott Library, where she manages descriptive metadata for the digital library. She oversees the Digital Exhibits Program and supports emerging technology projects. Her previous positions include serving as the metadata librarian for the Mountain West Digital Library, the executive director of the Utah Library Association, and she began her career in libraries as an instruction librarian. Her research interests include authority control in digital libraries, collaborative digitization, the intersection of digital humanities and digital libraries, and metadata community support. She received her MLS from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and I just have to say, Century of Black Mormons wouldn't exist without Anna. I was able to go to her and say what I wanted, and she somehow magically made it happen. So really happy to have her here. Next will be Jeff Turner. He's a PhD student in U.S. history. He has an MA in religion from Claremont Graduate University and an undergraduate degrees in philosophy and religious studies from Washington State University. Jeff studies immigration history, American religious history, and history of the American West. He is currently researching the religious implications of federal immigration restriction in the late 19th and early 20th century United States. He's getting a minor in digital humanities, and he was a graduate assistant also helping to make whatever was in my head become a digital reality. And Artis Parshall will be the next presenter. She's a historian, freelance researcher, specializing in Mormon history, and author. She co-edited with myself Mormonism, a historical encyclopedia, and is currently writing She Shall Be an Ensign, a history of the LDS Church told through the lives of Mormon women. Artis is co-editor of The Mormoness, or The Trials of Mary Maverick, a narrative of real events, and Boadicea, The Mormon Wife, Life Scenes in Utah, two 19th century dime novels that she has co-edited and brought to life again. She's the award-winning author of Pursue, Retake, and Punish, the 1857 Santa Clara Ambush, a fabulous article published in the Utah Historical Quarterly, which I assign to my Utah history students every time I teach Utah history. She blogs at Keep a Pitchin' In, and she is a vital researcher for Century of Black Mormons. After these three presenters talk about the process of building this digital database, we will have Robert Birch talk about the experience from the user's perspective. So it's a public history project, so what is this experience like for the public? Robert is president of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society of Utah, otherwise known as OGS. Fabulous organization. Please join a wonderful group to help you do genealogical research. He's also the director of the LDS Genesis Family History Committee. He is the historian for Omega Psi Phi Fraternity. He is a general board member of Utah Black Roundtable and board member for Sons and Daughters of the United States Middle Passage. And then we will have Jenny Reeder also comment on the digital components of this project. Jenny is the 19th century women's history specialist at the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As a member of that department web team, she has helped produce numerous essays, videos for the Church History Gospel Library app on church history topics and on global histories. She has a PhD in American history from George Mason University, where she studied American religious history, women's history, memory, and material culture. An integral part of her program included training in digital history And she worked at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media with the War Department Digital Archive, History Matters website, the National History Day website, instruction book, among other digital projects. So we have a wonderful panel here, and I will turn it over to Anna to begin the panel discussion. Yes. Thank you for the reminder. Please silence all of your electronic devices. Turn them off. Anything that buzzes, beeps, makes noises in the night, please turn them off in advance of the panel. Thanks for the reminder.
All right. I'm Anna Nietrauer. I'm the Digital Initiatives Librarian at the Marriott Library at the University of Utah. Often when people are working on digital projects for the first time, the idea of putting it online comes as a bit of an afterthought without a real understanding of the labor and time involved in developing a website. So I'm going to be a little bit technical in discussing what went into the creation of Century of Black Mormons, with the hope that this will be useful for anyone developing a similar project. So we're going to enter into the matrix, and we're going to focus solely on the digital part of digital public history. So when you're getting started with digital projects, I think that there are really four main questions that anyone needs to ask yourself whenever you're trying to put something up on the web. How you organize and get information ready for the web, how do you get a website up and running, how do you customize and maintain your site, and how do you make it look visually attractive and coherent. So collaboration with the library provided answers to these four questions, which I think anyone contemplating a digital public history project should consider. So getting information ready for the web, putting a project team together, and developing metadata and workflows and a project plan is what's in my wheelhouse as a digital initiatives librarian. We're fortunate to have people at my library who can provide the IT support needed to set up a website, install software on a server, and develop a customized theme for Century of Black Mormons. The answer to each of these questions in an organization like a large university library requires coordinating the expertise of multiple team members. But if you're doing your public history project solo or at an institution with fewer resources, it might mean learning and taking on these roles yourself, outsourcing your web hosting to a commercial vendor, or seeing some of these roles get collapsed. So we use Omeka S for Century of Black Mormons, which is also the software that we use for other digital exhibits at the Marriott Library. This is open source software released from the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. So open source software in this context means it's free for anyone to use. But if you want to get a site like this up and running, you do need to purchase web hosting and install it on a web server in order to use it. This is different from Omeka that was Omeka 1.1 or Omeka Classic or Omeka.net, which provides sort of a cloud-based way of creating digital exhibits. So when you look at a web page for Century of Black Mormons, it seems like a single web page, but we actually have a much more complicated structure in place that all comes together. So this is going to be kind of like a peek behind the curtain of what makes the site go. So the main part of the web page is a biographical essay, but you can also see that along the side we've got some more structured biographical and genealogical information right there. So if I scroll down to the bottom of a page, I get this window where it gives me access to primary source materials. And each item linked here has information about where it's coming from, since these were coming from different digital libraries affiliated with multiple institutions. So what looks like a one web page is actually much more complex. It has all this embedded biographical information, essentially from two mini databases that are customized exactly to the needs of Century of Black Mormons. So one of the biggest ingredients in getting something like this together is time. You'll notice how I've emphasized that there. So during the months when we were working on getting the site up and running, I spent a great deal of time researching figures in order to figure out how best to display the Century of Black Mormons data. And Professor Reeve had been planning on making Century of Black Mormons into a website for a long time and had thought out the features that he wanted to have, as well as having a great deal of research already developed for the first few people who were portrayed on the site. So having that clear vision and being able to have somebody say, yes, this is what I want, or no, this isn't going to work, it's good to have that moving forward whenever you're working on a digital public history project. So Professor Reeve had his own local database already developed for the project, which contained genealogical information, and our early discussions centered on how best to represent that information on the web. One idea that we discussed early on that ended up not working out was having the primary point of entry be the biographical information about a person and we would then embed an essay and links to primary sources, and having that person record be the primary kind of data point for the project. And that ended up not working out due to the way that Omeka places restrictions on formatted text in descriptive fields or metadata fields, which is actually a really good design decision on their part. So what ended up working out was structuring the site by having hierarchical web pages, having the essay be the main point of entry, and then linking out to those two other databases of biographical information and primary sources. Here you can see a snapshot of a project plan that we developed for Century of Black Mormons. It looks kind of a little bit crazy. It's a Gantt chart where I've color-coded different tasks and put initials of people who are responsible for different things. It's really useful to think of a project like this by splitting it up into the component parts and estimating the amount of time needed for each one, along with due dates. So we'd been talking about developing the site in the fall of 2017, but we only really got started in April 2018 with the idea of having a public launch in June. So being able to forecast out your tasks and think, well, we've got 80 hours of data entry that needs to happen somehow. How does that look like? We have to have data present on the web page in order for our web designer to be able to work her magic and make everything look visually coherent. Being aware of those dependencies and whose work depends on the larger team is really important when you're working on a project like this. Another thing that's important is developing and articulating your workflow. So we worked together on uploading a few sample items to make sure all the steps were documented. And this is like a tiny, tiny snapshot of a workflow that's maybe like 4 pages long, 5, something like that. So documenting your workflow for uploading content to your site, testing it, and making sure that other people can replicate it is really useful when you're building a project with multiple team members or even for yourself, so you can have a mental checklist of what you need to do every time you're adding a new person to the site. And it's basically Professor Reeve that's doing this, and hopefully that workflow is useful since he's doing the bulk of the data entry. Just to give you a little bit of a peek behind the curtain again into this site, if you look at the many items that we have associated with the Century of Black Mormons site, the database has two main types of items, individuals and images. So the individuals contain all of the biographical details, and the images represent the primary source documents. So both of these types of information required separate metadata templates with different data entry requirements. So for an individual, we needed to be sure to be able to express fields such as baptism, confirmation, and residences. For the primary source documents, we needed to be able to link out to its source digital library, have information about how somebody could cite or attribute it. Here again is the back end where the data entry happens, so you can see then how that gets translated into being represented on a web page. Omeka-S lets you set up custom vocabulary fields that are tied to the specific information needs of a project that you have. So this was really one of the benefits of choosing this for Century of Black Mormons. The software, as it's produced, didn't have fields like gender or birth date in it. And so that was some custom additional customization that we needed to do. Here's the data entry view and then the window of what a document looks like. And we started creating Century of Black Mormons only a few months after Omeka S got released out of beta. So we were really kind of flying by the seat of our pants, and we were really dissatisfied initially with how we wanted the documents to be displayed. We were really fortunate that this module called the IIIF Universal Viewer Module was released. We quickly tested it and put it in place so that it provides a better window for the documents where you can zoom in and really see some of the details, especially when you're dealing with handwriting and census records. So although the technical components, the infrastructure, and the project planning were key in developing this site, time and teamwork, I think, are really the essential ingredients if you're taking on a digital public history project like this. Don't underestimate the importance of these things when you're planning your own digital projects. I usually try to plan out a project and then add an extra 6 weeks or month as a buffer, just because it's so easy to run into technological issues or unknowns, or all of a sudden the person that does IT support for you has gone on vacation, and you need to plan for the unexpected in that way. I think when we were planning this project, we maybe had a buffer of just maybe a couple weeks, and we were really cutting it close, but it happened, so it all worked out really well. One thing that I want you to take away from this is that you can do this too. So Century of Black Mormons was a really complex project, and it happened to need a detailed data structure, dedicated project team, and IT support. If you're working on developing a site like this, I'd advise you to kind of assess the tools that you have on hand and making them work for you. So this is just one way to do digital public history, not the only way. We could have accomplished this with a different system, and the site would have looked very different, but it still would be making history accessible to the public. And so hopefully you have a sense of the technical considerations and project planning that went into developing this site. I'm happy to talk about this afterwards. And now the rest of the panel will talk about even more aspects of the site.
Cool. Thank you all for coming. My name is Jeff, and my title, my paper title is called Visualizing Past Mormons. Humans are a storytelling people, but the kinds of stories we tell vary widely depending on the content, time, teller, and listener. Some stories are personal. Some lay out a series of facts in a linear way, hoping to show cause and effect. Some compare unlikely narratives. Some explore entangled webs of interactions. And some, maybe more common to us in this room, show change over time. Century of Black Mormons ultimately is a storytelling project. Cool. For stories, though, medium matters. A database demands that scholars confront the techne or praxis of the technologically complicated lives in which users exist. In other words, making a database stresses that we think about how people live digital lives in the hopes that they might at some point include Century of Black Mormons in them. One writer, commonly known as the Hacker Hemingway, such a cool nickname, has said, quote, "The word, in the end, is the only system of encoding thoughts, and for our purposes, transmitting stories. The only medium that is not fungible, that refuses to dissolve in the devouring torrent of electronic media." Words for Century of Black Mormons make the meat of the project, without which it would be nothing. Words ground the meaning and experience of the experiences of those people in the past to readers in the present. But technology muddies that connection between past and present. Digital humanist Alan Liu writes of a new technological historicism in the 21st century. He says, quote, "It is history itself that incessantly loosens people from their land, ancestors, nation, and so on, to make them look away from, yet hunger for, the haunted connectivity that is the sense of history in the first place." So in thinking about how to connect users in the present with people in the past, we had to think about how to package our torrent of electronic media, or background, visuals, and ways into the data in a way that framed and centered the text of our stories, the narratives of the lives of early Black Mormons themselves. This talk focuses on the framing. It deals with the visual choices we made in order to create a technological background that we hope might funnel users and readers into the complex words and worlds that represent the lives of early Black Mormons. First, the genetic structure. Individual biographies serve as the building blocks in the DNA of the site. They comprise the site's center. So just one example, maybe a fairly famous one. This is what the building block looks like. We can get at those biographies through the signifiers of names. Historians like John O'Malley and Richard Price have asked, what's in a name? Social historians have resoundingly answered that names carry with them the lives and experiences of common individuals, or that the names write history from the ground up, or at least they start to. For social historians, names recover the lost voices of people in the past. The question for Century of Black Mormons, then, was how to funnel users toward the names of early Black Mormons. We settled on a variety of entry points into the names in the database. The four current entry points, and we constantly talk about these, every once in a while we talk about these, are who, where, when, and how many. These different entry points reflect different logics for organizing and understanding the stories of early Black Mormons in relation to one another. So first, the who. It is what it sounds like. It's an alphabetical list of everyone currently entered into the database without respect to other biographical details. This entry point might best facilitate users whose interest lies in specific individuals and who already know whom they're looking for. So for example, you might think of genealogists, descendants, or historians. The who entry point seemed like the most obvious and least problematic for us in terms of organizing and providing access to the names of early Black Mormons. The only problem we encountered here was that some individual records showed evidence of baptism but did not list a name. For those individuals, we used what descriptors we could, like sailor, or if we didn't have that much information, we left the name as unknown. Next, the where. So glad we have Wi-Fi. The where highlights that early Black Mormons lived spatial lives. The map tool that we use collates individuals as pinpoints on a map. And notice the fancy icons here, which are the symbol of the site, that Paul coded into the map himself. He's so good, he could teach at Hogwarts. We toyed with various mapping tools to test their usefulness and compatibility with Omeka S, which Anna talked about. The map tool that we currently use is an open access slide-based map called StoryMap.js. Nightlab, a community of developers at Northwestern University, made StoryMap.js as an easy-to-use visualization tool that they mainly meant for journalism. The reason that we chose this tool is because of its ability to hyperlink each individual node to an individual biographical page. So if you just click on a node, this link will go to the biographical page of that person. And equally importantly, because it was easy enough for us to figure out how to use and how to embed within the site. Each node represents the baptism location for early Black Mormons and lists a name, hyperlink, date, place, and baptizer if that information is available. The assumption that this tool makes is that researchers can identify a baptismal location with a record of conversion. That's an assumption that we're operating on. And honestly, it hasn't caused us serious problems thus far. As a whole, the map shows a snapshot of the geographic diversity of Black converts into Mormonism. You can see the spread out and international nature of it.
What are the three out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Those are people who were baptized on a ship. So we identified them as Sailor 1, 2, and 3. That's all the information we have. There are a few pitfalls for our current mapping tool. First, the map is static. It doesn't show the movement and migrations of these individuals before and after conversion. We have such data, at least for some converts, and being able to visualize the movements for converts might better highlight the paths that led to conversion, the movement of kin, moments of commitment or retention, and the moments that some converts left Mormonism for other faiths. Second, the slide logic of our mapping tool limits some of the openness for interactivity from the user. There aren't really easily accessible Zoom features. You kind of have to fiddle with it to understand it. And there really isn't a way to hide the slide nature of the map, which is my pet peeve. I don't know if other people have that, so maybe that's just me. Lastly, and this is a bit of a nitpick on my part, the map layer doesn't represent the changing historical nature of cities, nations, and boundaries or borders. An ideal map, if we were much better at coding, would have the flexibility to represent individuals as mobile, would allow for more interactivity with the user, and would visually show some of the crossing of borders. This ideal mapping tool for us doesn't exist yet. Omeka S is really brand new. Although the University of Virginia is developing a tool called Neatline that will hopefully be able to integrate a lot of these features that we hope to use in the future. Until then, we're tailoring this tool as best we can, and some of us are learning JavaScript in the hopes of creating custom visualizations on a more open source mapping tool like Leaflet combined with D3JS or something like that. Next, the when. WEN organizes early Black Mormons chronologically by the date of their baptism into the faith. Here, the slide-based logic of the tool, also developed by Knight Lab at Northwestern University, makes more sense because of time's linear progression. The data on each slide is like the data in our mapping tools, so it includes a lot of the same information, also with a link to the biographical page of the person. However, the strength of the tool rests in collating moments of conversions, which you can see at the bottom. Oh, cool, it shows up great. Awesome. As researchers enter more biographies into the database, the clusters of conversion moments will become more complete. This tool should provide an easy visual for historians to contextualize the collective moments of conversion within broader regional and religious history. Timelines, though, structure data in a way that might artificially create connection. For example, clusters of nodes on a timeline might make it seem like those nodes are related to one another. And they might be. But determining the relationships between nodes and individuals requires research. And the timeline might or might not be the best visual to represent that particular connectivity. Nevertheless, the timeline provides a way for users into the database if they're operating on limited information. Maybe a researcher or descendant is interested in a specific year, or has a date but doesn't have a name for the individual that they're interested in. The timeline will present information in such a way that those users will be able to identify and read about the individual that the user is interested in. Okay. Last but not least, how many? Cool. How many is the only entry point that doesn't directly connect to individual names in the database? This entry point considers both the data set as a whole and tries to demonstrate to the user some transparency about the progress of the research project. Of the questions that the How Many page tracks, some of the most significant have to do with the collective personal information of early Black Mormons. We track, for example, the percentage of infant baptisms, gender disparity, retention and faith transitions, priesthood ordination, temple participation, regional difference, and slave status. These are the collective markers that have stood out as interesting quantitative data at this point in the research. And different markers might arise as more stories join the database. These numbers treat the populace in our data set as uniform. As such, the How Many page hides the individual identities and stories of early Black Mormons. It should, though, provide a useful tool for historians trying to understand race in the early church and as a means for transparency to the user. One future avenue that we hope to include in the database is to visually represent the social and kinship networks of individuals in what people call a sociogram. It's like a dot with a bunch of lines. It's more complicated than that. A sociogram relies on network theory to visualize the bidirectional connections between nodes that coexist in a greater network. For our purposes, a sociogram would be able to visually represent family connections and consistent social interactions by visually drawing lines between individuals, which in turn would rearrange the shape of the diagram itself. The diagram can then visually represent connections between and within kinship and social networks, and can also identify which individuals and families might have been more isolated than others. Sociogramming, though, requires a more complete data set and a thorough standard for representing network connectedness, of which there have been a few studies in American history which have set some precedents for this, but it's really kind of up in the air in terms of standards for measuring connectedness. The potential upside, though, can reveal much about the entangled worlds of early Black Mormons. Each entry point has its distinctive utility and drawbacks. We think that the whole, though, is greater than the sum of each part. The purpose of the entry points is twofold. First, they allow users to explore stories through a calculated torrent of electronic media. In other words, entry points give users a sense of agency and involvement through the playfulness with the database itself. Second, they lead users to individual biographies, and thereby individual stories. The visualizations recognize the contingency of place and time for each individual, and thereby guide users to biographies through the measures common in the practice of history and genealogy. The words in these narratives provide encoded thoughts and transmitted stories for the reader's consumption. We hope that these entry points will highlight the variety of stories found within each biography. They're personal, they often lay out a series of facts, they demonstrate change over time, and their collection in one database juxtaposes unlikely narratives and reveals entangled webs of interactions. The collection of these stories, we hope, might demystify the connectivity in our own relationships with people in the historical past, and might tie us in the present with the land, ancestors, and experiences that inhabited the lives of Black Mormons in the past. Thank you.
Membership records of members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have evolved from informal lists to handwritten ledgers to individual paper records to electronic databases. In all those records from many places and many times, I have yet to see a formal church record requesting an indication of a person's race. In the absence of such recorded designations, then, how does the Century of Black Mormons team, how have we gone about identifying Black Mormons for inclusion in our database? I'm proud of the techniques we've developed, and I'll take you on a sort of a detective journey today. In some cases, Black Latter-day Saints were already well known. There was no need for us to discover Elijah Abel, a priesthood holder ordained in the earliest days of the church, or Jane Manning James, an early convert who is the subject of Quincy Newell's new biography and the major figure in a movie that many of us will see this weekend, Jane and Emma. The labor there was not in identifying the people, but in gathering primary source material and in verifying the details of their church membership and in stripping away legends that had grown up around, among them. Another group of early Black Latter-day Saints was familiar to historians, but has not been sufficiently documented. These included enslaved men and women brought to Utah by Southern converts to Mormonism. Were these men and women brought to Utah against their will, bona fide members of the church? Tanya Ryder, who counts some of those enslaved people among her ancestors, has taken the lead in untangling those family lines and documenting dozens of people through professional genealogical techniques that are more or less identical to genealogical research for any group, with the exception, with the added difficulty, that too often African Americans have been omitted from the common records that white Americans take for granted when they trace their family history. A third group of Black Mormons has been discovered through what I think of as dumb luck, although a kinder description might be through scholarly preparation or keen observation. I count among this class the discovery of three Black sailors that have already been mentioned today aboard the Mormon immigrant ship, the International, in 1853. I do not remember now why I happened to have pulled up the record of the International's crossing. It certainly had nothing to do with Century of Black Mormons, because I do recall how startled I was to find that among the ship's crew who were baptized in a vat on the deck of that ship were three unnamed men referred to as Negroes. Another instance of recovering the life of a Black Latter-day Saint deserves a far more respectful descriptor than dumb luck. But I mention it here because it came about not through the brilliance of our research, but through an agency that was out of our control. After the database had gone live, Paul was contacted by descendants of a man named Nelson Holder Ritchie. Their ancestor was a Black man, they told Paul, something that had been more or less concealed throughout the 20th century when Nelson's descendants were being ordained to the priesthood and marrying in the temple. But now they wanted their ancestor to be known and remembered by inclusion in the Century of Black Mormons. They had already done a great deal of research, which Paul was able to help them to arrange and supplement through his work. And so Nelson Holder Ritchie, a Black saint whom we had not discovered ourselves, is remembered in the database. Now I want to walk you through a case study that illustrates many of the techniques that have so far proved useful to the project. Beyond the hard work and detailed research that is common to all good scholarly projects, we quickly noticed one frequent factor in identifying previously forgotten Black Mormons. Watch for signs of racism, both subtle and blatant. As a people, we have never been delicate about distinguishing between Black and white, even when officially there was no requirement for the discrimination in the fact of membership records. While going through membership records to document the baptism of an early member of our project, Paul noticed that colored man and colored woman had been written next to the names of one Black family, and he wondered if other clerks had done the same thing. Indeed, they had. Between the two of us, we scrolled through thousands of pages of membership records, beginning with the southern states, but it's important to note that clerks elsewhere in the United States made the same notation. That bit of racism intended to put some church members into an undesirable lower class served all these years later to make those saints stand out in a positive way, newly recognized Black Mormons to be remembered for their difficult religious choices. And here we get a little bit of a variety. Instead of colored, she's part Negro. Sometimes the racism was more direct. A Christmas Eve letter in 1909 carries these lines. We have three families of colored people, all of whom have been in the church 8 or 10 years. One family in Minneapolis, Minnesota, one in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and one in South Bend, Indiana. They have been good, faithful people, but so much in evidence in our meetings that investigators have been kept away from our services. So with this lesson before us, we have done no work among the colored people for at least 7 years. That from a mission president. Although the letter did not name these colored people whose presence kept away desirable investigators, this was an obvious indication that we should look for Black Mormons in the congregations of those three cities. It was easy to identify Elijah A. Banks of Minneapolis. An earlier mission president had once responded to a complaint that a white woman had married a Black man named Banks, in which he told the writer, in effect, to mind his own business, that we, quote, do not consider this any bar to their being proper candidates for admittance into the fold of Christ. God is no respecter of persons and is as anxious to save the souls of our Black brethren as he is of the white. Minneapolis branch records of the early 20th century revealed that Elijah A. Banks, born enslaved in Tennessee, was a faithful participant in the branch. Now I have to tell a story on myself. Years before the Century of Black Mormons was begun, I had featured this 1903 picture of the Minneapolis congregation on my Mormon history blog, but I had not seen what was there right in the photo for me to see. There in the upper right corner, so obvious to me now, is the unmistakable face of Elijah A. Banks. Oshkosh, Wisconsin was another of the locations mentioned in that letter where we had reason to suspect we could find a Black Mormon. The letter had been written in the last days of 1909. The 1910 census of the U.S. population was taken about 4 months later. Membership records indicated who was a Mormon, but not that Mormon's race. The census recorded the race of each person listed, but of course made no mention of religion. Was it possible that we could combine the two sets of records to solve our puzzle? In fact, it was possible. Searching the 1910 census for the names of every member in the mission records connected to Oshkosh, it didn't take Paul very long to zero in on the family of, come on, technology, Richard and Esther Nettie Kirchhoff and their two sons. The census recorded Nettie as mulatto, married to a white German immigrant. Nettie and her two sons were eligible for inclusion in the Century of Black Mormons. Meanwhile, I was doing, or attempting to do, the same thing to find the suspected presence of a black Mormon in South Bend, Indiana. I searched the membership records of the Northern Indiana Conference for the period surrounding 1909. There weren't many names to search, and the census indicated that they were all white. So I left the records of baptized members and scanned through the lists of marriages and blessings and deaths. I did find the 1902 baby blessing of Chester Hood, whom the 1910 census indicated was black, but I could find no mention of his parents in the Indiana membership records. At that time, Mormon missionaries frequently blessed the children of non-Mormon parents, and that could easily have been the case with Chester Hood. And Paul, being a stickler for evidence that black Mormons are both black and Mormons, I couldn't take it for granted that the Hoods were those black faces in the South Bend branch. So I resorted to learning as much as I could about the Hoods using standard genealogical methods not related to church membership. I found that they were part of a large clan who had settled in Cass County, Michigan, long before the Civil War, setting up a community of free black families where they could vote and where this group was very successful in their farming. The census records the valuation of their farms at being five, six, seven times the worth of most of their white neighbors, including my own partial ancestors who lived in the next county. The baptisms of any Mormons in Cass County, even though it was only 10 miles away from South Bend, would have been recorded in an entirely separate set of church books. So I searched the membership records of the Michigan Conference and quickly found the baptism records of that infant's parents, George and Edna Hood. What's more, I found the baptism record of that infant's grandmother, Frances Stewart Hood. We now had evidence of three generations of a black family who were members of the church early in the 20th century. I continued to learn about Frances Hood and her Mormon descendants through typical genealogical sources, research of the kind that would have allowed me to write an adequate, if impersonal, account of their lives for our database. But remember that element of dumb luck that I said sometimes plays a role in our research? It reared its beautiful head not once, but twice in the case of Frances Hood. During the week that I was researching Frances's life, I continued work on other unrelated projects. One of those projects was my massive compilation of historic Mormon correspondence. I was including letters that the Deseret News published weekly from missionaries around the world. Typing merrily away one day, I unexpectedly came face to face with the Hoods in a letter from the missionary who baptized them. He recounted a dream that had converted George Hood to the gospel, and he then described their baptism. At 11 a.m., over 300 people with about 100 vehicles met at a selected spot on the bank of the Christian Creek and listened with interest to an open-air service, which consisted of singing "O My Father," prayer, and a discussion of the first principles of the gospel. In solemn silence stepped forward Mr. George Hood, wife and mother, and were immersed in the pure stream. The missionary's letter doesn't mention the race of the Hood family. Had I transcribed that letter even a single week earlier, I would not have known it had any reference to black Mormons. And given the volume of typing I do every week, I think it impossible that I would have remembered George Hood when I next ran across him as the father of the infant blessed in Indiana. Dumb luck. During the same week, in yet another unrelated project, I was paging through issues of Liahona the Elder's Journal, the old church missionary magazine, looking for material that might be useful for my blog. In 1907 and 08, that magazine published the very short testimonies of Latter-day Saints in the missions of the United States. There are hundreds of these testimonies, page after page, each page looking at first glance like every other such page. But on this page, my eye fell on the names of Frances and George Hood, I had found the voice of a Black Mormon woman from more than a century earlier testifying to her faith. Again, had I been surveying the Liahona a week earlier, I would not have known Francis's name. Even on the very day I found these lines, had I blinked as I scrolled through the pages, I would have missed it. Dumb luck again. Once we have identified a new-to-us Black Mormon, we always check the Family Search database. Often that database cannot tell us anything we don't already know, because often the only record there for our Black Mormons was taken from the very membership record that helped us find such members in the first place. But the case of Francis Hood illustrates the value of checking Family Search anyway. First, at some point in the 20th century, the church established the practice of completing temple ordinances for all Latter-day Saints who died before visiting a temple themselves. In a few cases, this has led to the discovery, one that pleases us more than perhaps it ought to, that some Black Mormons received temple ordinances before 1978. They were barred from the temples in life, but in death, that absence of racial designation on their records allowed them access to the temples posthumously. In Francis's case, I discovered that someone had mistaken her gender. Not only had Francis received temple ordinances before the racial restriction was lifted, she had also been ordained to the priesthood. A member of the Family Search staff helped me straighten out those records in a way that allowed us to preserve the record of Francis's original baptism, something we think is important because it makes visible the religious choice that Francis made during her own lifetime. Family Search proved most useful in Francis's case in another way. While few Family Search records of Black Mormons, other than the famous cases like Elijah Abel and Jane Manning James, show any evidence of current family involvement, a look at the records for Francis's extended family suggested that she still had Mormon relatives. Someone had done a little work cleaning up errors in the genealogical data. Because Family Search allows you to send messages to those who have made such efforts, I contacted one such contributor. The response came from a woman very excited to talk about the family. Her husband was a descendant of one of Francis's brothers, and he had joined the church without any idea that a long-ago aunt had ever been a Mormon. She and her husband wanted to help and were enthusiastic about Francis being a part of Century of Black Mormons, but they did not know more than I had already learned about their family history. They had been in touch with the distant cousins, though, who still lived in the old family area, and they were sure she would know things. The next I heard from them was written in a much more subdued tone. That distant cousin, they said, had opinions about Mormons. She denied us permission to reproduce a family-owned image. She wanted nothing to do with our project. That seemed to be the end of that trail. But a few days later, at 4:24 in the morning, that frosty woman with the opinions sent me a brief email. A cousin contacted me about your project. Please tell me more about it. So I did. I explained the whos and wheres and whats. I told her that Century of Black Mormons is a secular project hosted at the University of Utah and that it was not directed in any way by the LDS Church. I summarized my findings to date and offered her scans of every record found. I told her that our intention was, quote, to honor the memory of people who made a religious choice that wasn't always the easiest one they could have made. We are working to tell their stories with respect and with accuracy. 24 minutes later, her response came. This is fascinating. I would very much like to be a part of this project. This woman was able to verify many of the facts already found, and with her intimate knowledge of local history and geography, she corrected a few of my drafted statements. And she sent me a family picture. Before I show it, I want to stress that this is not an image of Francis Stuart Hood. The family is not aware of any such image. It is the photograph of Francis's sister, Sarah, who was not a Mormon. But to whatever degree there is a family resemblance between sisters, this is as close as we come to recovering the image of our pioneering Black sister from Michigan, shared with us only through the goodwill of non-Mormon family members. The research for every individual in Century of Black Mormons takes its own course. In summary, some of the tools for identifying previously unknown Black members typically include, 1, being alert to signs of racism. whether it is a single overt act or whether it is a systemic discrimination, like flagging membership records with the word colored. Recognizing this racism is often the first indication that a black man or black woman has defied bigotry to follow religious conviction. 2, good genealogical research practices. I haven't detailed the genealogical work involved because it involves the same sorts of research that solves family history problems of all kinds. 3, unpredictable and largely unexplainable circumstances. Whether you call it dumb luck, as I have done here, or coincidence, or if this were a devotional context rather than a scholarly one, some of us would offer a decidedly more otherworldly cause. We are often more successful when we accept that we are not fully in control of our own research. And 4, seeking out others with a shared interest in some aspect of our work. Courtesy, respect, openness, and a willingness to learn from those who are less credentialed or scholarly than we think is ideal can bring allies in unexpected places. The Century of Black Mormons Project is unlike any I have ever worked on before. It is a project that calls for every bit of experience or native talent I can muster. And yet, after whatever I can offer, the result does not belong to me. No matter how trite it sounds, it is an honor to restore to memory the names and life choices of some of the most faithful men and women I have ever studied. I respond to their life stories because of what they and I share as Mormons. I know I cannot fully appreciate their choices because I do not know their lives as black men and black women. What we can do through research will be made incalculably more valuable as members of the black community add an understanding that I can only support through basic research. Thank you.
So I'm really, as the president of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society, really excited about this project. This is a project that Paul told my wife and I about some time back, and we're really, really anticipating getting to see the results of this project. I'm most excited about it because it brings to light the original members from out east, because a lot of times when we talk about here in Utah, Latter-day Saints, we're talking about folk who traveled out here and made a home out here and are, in many cases, the entire family is still here. So it's particularly important to me since the next conference, next year, is going to be in Rochester, New York, where most of these black Latter-day Saints would have joined the church. And so maybe we'll even get an opportunity to learn a little bit more about them and where they're from and their families when we get out to Rochester. So hopefully we'll be able to visit those. I always had the impression before coming to this conference that, you know, there's just a lot of Molly folks out here who really don't talk about real issues. And then I got here in a class today, and this little white girl talking about smashing babies against trees, and I'm thinking, like, what did I come to? It's like, oh, my goodness, that was... And so quickly opened my eyes to the fact that perhaps at some of these conferences, people do learn things that we don't necessarily get shared with the rest of the membership. It's like, wow. Okay, so we do talk about hard things. But I don't want to talk about this so much as an end user as more of to try to leave a positive message or a positive thought about this whole process, because when I look at these, this is about doing what the Afro-American and Historical and Genealogical Society has been founded on, is to bring forth stories that have been forgotten in this community and the communities out east and the communities in the Caribbean and the communities in South America and the communities in Africa. We're part of an organization who's done a lot of work to bring those names forward from oral history and everything else. So to me, This is a very inspiring project. In the East, around New York and New England, at the advent of the LDS Church, free black folks joined the fervor of the day to find a place of worship which best filled their spiritual needs and matched most closely their idea of what God's church would be. In that fervor arose the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with a young leader who had stole the principle that the Father's children, all of his children, were the same. This church held the tenets and manifestations of the beloved family they had been seeking. The new church held in Eastern free blacks the promise that it, more than any society in the land, held them to be in equal standing in the eyes of the Lord. The land was young and held great potential. Now the potential of equality of faith was at hand. This was the promise which fostered the confidence of the Negro who joined the early church. They were free and held fast to the hope of equality through faith. Jane Manning's faith was so sure that she and her family walked from Connecticut to Nauvoo with the hope of living that promise. It is fitting that this project, Century of Black Mormons, recognizes that free people of color were freely choosing to walk as saints. This project reminds us, in the fact, in the light of the theme of this conference, isolation to integration, we started first with integration and moved to isolation. And now we struggle to return to true integration. That is the natural affection of one sibling toward another in the true manifestations of God's beloved family. This project is important because it returns to light and begins to complete the writing of the chapters of the lives of those faithful who have been not forgotten, but hidden. It begins to truly change the narrative of what the exercise of faith is, and changes the narrative of what an original Latter-day Saint looked like. MHA was founded on the idea of remembering Latter-day Saints and preserving their stories of struggle, faith, and triumph. We can now fully begin to have those difficult conversations that we must have surrounding the divinity of all of God's progeny. We can fully begin to provide greater examples of steadfast devotion to the academics, Sunday school teachers like myself, and other keepers of the faith. We can increase their knowledge and inspire confidence in the full understanding that the standard of truth is being erected. We can now begin to learn our truth as a family in God's host of believers. We can now teach the truth to all of the United States, the Caribbean, Central and South America, and the continent of Africa. We can begin to demonstrate in a real way we are indeed one beloved family of God. We can touch the hearts and change the hearts of those who struggle to understand and to believe. So many were driven away despite their sincere demonstrations of devotion to doctrine and loyalty to leadership. That will continue to remind us that we can fail at this work of coming to the full integration of the family. But I am hopeful that those like you who do the difficult work, which creates the foundation of understanding based in fact and data, can help to make room for the divine providence of the Lord and help to establish forever the fullness of the beloved family.
I first met E.G. Jones when I was working on a collection of Latter-day Saint Women's Discourses, and I came across a talk that was written by this this wonderful talk on faith written by a woman named E.G. Jones that was published in the Women's Exponent, but it was actually reprinted. It was printed initially in the Improvement Star, which was a manuscript newspaper from the Salt Lake City 11th Ward Young Ladies Mutual Improvement Association. I wanted to include the talk in our collection, in our book, but we didn't know anything about E.G. Jones. And so we embarked on a lot of research. We found her in the 11th Ward Census, Eleanor Georgina Jones. We knew that she was born in Nashville, Tennessee, and in 1833.
It's not a fun
one. Oh, that's going to be helpful. Thanks. Yeah. And that that led us to... There you go. Thanks. Thank you. That led us to the Nashville census records. In 1850, we found her listed with her family, with her mother, who was mixed race, and a man who was her mother's husband, who was black. And the children were listed. They were all born in different states, in Tennessee, in Virginia, in Kentucky. And then they ended up in Cincinnati, Ohio. And she joined the church, her sister joined the church. She came across to the plains, to Salt Lake City. Now, if we think about it, this is a really treacherous time for black people in the South between 1833 and 1850. When she came to Salt Lake City, she was always included in the census as white. So basically, she was passing as white. We couldn't find any more information on this woman other than this, that she moved back and forth between Utah and California, Salt Lake City and California, that she gave this talk in the Young Women's in Salt Lake City 11th Ward, that she was a member of the Salt Lake City 11th Ward Relief Society, that she did temple work in the Logan Temple, and she did temple work for her deceased family, that her son received the priesthood, that she... donated to the Salt Lake City Temple. We have no personal writings and no photographs. We didn't even know when she died. And finally, we discovered that she died in 1922 in Redding, California. We found a death certificate, and so we ordered that, and it said that she had been there for 10 days, and she died of a stroke. And she's buried in an unmarked grave. And so this... is why I'm here, because Eleanor Georgina Jones wanted to be found. And it's also why I'm here, because I have not yet written the entry for Eleanor Georgina Jones for the Century of Black Mormons, which I promised Paul I would write well over a year ago, right? So I'm now responsible to all of you publicly for that. But I want to talk briefly about why this database, this website, this project, these stories are so important. Actually, before I get into that, let me go back to E.G. Jones. I keep thinking, as I've been thinking about this session, about Benedict Anderson and his idea of imagined communities, and how those imagined communities cross borders and nations, but they create this identity. And that's what I think this project is. It's an imagined community, but it's a real community, but it's imagined. And the only way that it's been able to come together is through this database. We know that Jane Manning James belongs to that community, and we know that Elijah Abels belongs to that community, and we know that so many more people belong to that community, but it's also a community where little E.G. Jones can belong, and where she can be found, and her story can be told. I want to talk just a little bit about digital history. I had the privilege of working at George Mason University with Roy Rosenzweig, and he was a fantastic person. And in his book with David Thelen, he talked about the presence of the past. He talked about how public history is people's history, and about how the power of stories are used to create forges or links with a familial past. It's an interesting study. He looks at how... both of them do this very intensive survey of people, of Americans, and how they view their past, and how much they hated their history classes in high school or even college, and they don't read history books, but they love family stories, and they love museums, and they love historical fiction and films. And so they realized that people actually use the past as a way to talk about grappling and profound questions today, that the past really has a ubiquitous presence with us today. Numbers don't tell the story, people do. But the people add up into pretty significant numbers. So part of this digital revolution, I want to talk about quickly about some of the benefits of the digital revolution. We have this capacity of gathering information and data together in one place. We have accessibility, where we can reach multiple audiences in different ways. We have flexibility, where we can use multiple formats and media. We can combine sound and image and moving pictures and words in a way that a book could never do. We have the flexibility also allows us to reach a diverse audience and to include a diverse subject matter. The digital world also allows us a great deal of manipulability, which is really important in the way that we use information and being honest and open and about that information, that interactivity where we are connecting things, and the hypertextuality, which is also non-linearity, where we can link things together and where one thing can lead you to another thing. And it's not like reading a book from the beginning to the end, but it's like tracing someone or going where you want to go. There's also some dangers or hazards of digital history. And one of them is quality. So we have problems with authenticity. There's a lot of junk on the interwebs. We get junk searches, and where we try to hone in. We also learn about the need to hone in on sources and pay attention to those sources and recognize where those sources are coming from, who they're funded by, all of the Facebook issues and the election issues. But that gives us a reason to be really smart and astute historians. There's the problem of durability. How are we going to be able to preserve things in their original forms as format and technology change over time? There's also the problem of readability. Who is the author of this? Where do we get these sources? And hypertext scholarship can often disrupt the conventions of reading a scholarly article or a scholarly monologue. There's sometimes difficulty in a digital format in finding a traditional thesis. There's a problem of passivity, where historians prefer to use the words maybe or probably, and computers use the words yes or no. So that's also an issue that's a little bit different in a digital format. And then there's also the case, just as much as accessibility is important in digital work, of inaccessibility. Who does not have access to this database? Who does not know how to find it or how to use it, or where to go with it or what to do with it? So there's both positives and negatives, and I actually think that the positives outweigh the negatives, but I think we have to be aware of those hazards. So I briefly wanted to bring up this Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media. And their purpose, I love this because I think it really fits in with understanding how powerful this database is to democratize history, to make it equal, and to make it equally accessible, and to make it equal where people can participate and contribute to it. The Center for History and New Media was a great place for me to learn about creating websites and open source digital tools to preserve and present the past, to transform scholarly access across the humanities, to advance historical education and historical understanding, and to encourage popular participation in the practice of history. So that's part of what's happening here. I was able to work on the papers of the War Department, which, interestingly enough, on the night of November 18th, 1800, fire devastated the United States War Office, consuming records and papers and books that were stored there. And 2 weeks later, the Secretary of War, Samuel Dexter, lamented in a letter that all the papers in my office have been destroyed. So for the past two centuries, the official records of the War Department effectively began with his letter. So the papers of the War Department, this project is a very innovative digital project that that has gathered 55,000 long-lost documents of the early War Department, whether they be letters that were sent to certain places or letter copybooks, and is making that a virtual digital archive, very similar to A Century of Black Mormons in bringing things from all over. And that's one of the greatest benefits of a digital project. Another thing that I love about this project is that you can both explore the collection, but you can also contribute to it. You can transcribe it and be a part of it and be a part of preserving history and of owning history. Anna talked a little bit about Omeka, which is a great publishing platform for museums and historical societies, scholars, enthusiasts, and educators to bring together some of the things that they've been able to do. She also pointed out some of the downfalls or some of the missing parts where they, and Jeff talked about this too, of where they had to draw on other platforms. Century of Black Mormons really is an amazing project. The way that they're able to frame, Jeff talked about this, about framing matters, about pulling in these names. Artists talked about bringing in the stories of these people that are lost in the space of this picture. But we've been able to bring them together and bring them into an imagined community. Jeff talked a little bit about artificial connections, and there's always that problem. We don't know exactly. We're prevented from this with the static maps of knowing the transitions and the transformations and the comings and goings of these imagined communities, how the boundaries have changed and the borders have changed. But with artists' keen observation, not dumb luck, keen observation, she's one of the most talented people I know. And with the work of so many other people, we can bring this together and we can create a place where these people have names and that they have a place in history. We have such a great future in digital history. I have a million different projects that I have in mind. In 1881, for example, Sarah Kimball started a collection of people's life sketches. It was involved with the 1880 Jubilee celebration of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And she asked people to write down their life sketches, and she put them in a box called the Memorial Jubilee Box. And she deposited it, it was a time capsule essentially, at the historian's office. And they opened it 30 years later, and they distributed the contents to the oldest living female descendant. So these things are spread out all over, and I would love to do like the papers of the War Department and bring them together and have a virtual archive of the 1881 Jubilee Memorial Box. We've also had other projects at the Church History Library where we're trying to digitize all the Relief Society minute books. And that's going to take a lot of crowdsourcing, a lot of people transcribing and contributing to that. But what a wonderful source, a wonderful way to find access to local history records that are generally unused, underutilized, and undervalued. It's great for family history. It's great for academic scholarly history. We're also collecting the Eliza R. Snow sermons. We're going through all the minute books where she could have spoken, and we're going to create a database for that. So in closing, and I want to leave plenty of time for questions, we're in an exciting place, and we all have a responsibility to understand that and to get into it, to be a part of it, to not only read through it and study from it and utilize the resources, but to contribute to it and to make a part of this history. So let's have some great discussion and great questions. Is that okay, Paul?